Hey guys, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We will get to the interview very shortly with Rory McIlroy. Real quick, wanted to make a quick announcement. We are giving away a Callaway Epic Driver for free right here on this podcast. All you have to do, this couldn't be easier, just subscribe to this podcast, go into iTunes, leave a review, 5-star review, whatever you want to leave, leave a funny comment with it, whatever, it can be any kind of essay, it can be as short or as long as you want. Leave a funny review in iTunes for us. Independent third party is going to go through all of these and choose the funniest response, funniest review, and we are going to send you a Callaway Epic Driver for that. Again, totally free. Take 2 seconds of your time, go in and review it in iTunes, enter yourself in to win this Epic Driver. For now, let's get to the interview with Rory McIlroy.
On the tee from Northern Ireland, Rory McIlroy.
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. I'm Chris Solomon, joined for the second time, 4-time major champion, number 2 player in the world, and maybe the most bored guy I know at the moment, Rory McIlroy. How bad is it, man?
It's so bad that I actually asked you to come back on the podcast, so that's how bored I am. It's good. I didn't ask you this morning whether it was too soon to come back on, but thankfully, you give me another shot, so here I am.
Yeah, really inconvenient for me. It was real tough to move my schedule around to make this happen, but you know that's what we do for our guests. But so you've been holed up with injury for a while. I imagine how far along are you in the wedding planning? How much of your time is that taking up at the moment?
Yeah, that's basically, you know, I'm not really much good for anything else right now, so at least I can lend a bit of time to that. It's going well. We're back in Northern Ireland for the next couple of days and getting a few things sorted. But it's sort of, I was just saying to you there, it's annoying because it's, you know, I feel like I can do everything else that I want. Like I can perform everyday activities and, you know, I feel comfortable. I can take a deep breath again. I can sleep well, but I'm uncomfortable swinging a golf club. So obviously that's what I want to do. So, it's a little bit frustrating at the minute, but I know just with a little bit of rest, hopefully I'll be back hitting balls in a couple of weeks, and then that gives me a decent amount of time to get ready for trying to get back for Mexico, but ultimately, obviously, trying to get ready for the start of April and be ready for Augusta.
Yeah, so that was my next question. Sounds like Mexico is still the goal. Now, hearing you talk about it now, I didn't get the sense when I was watching you in South Africa that it was bothering you that much, that you really had that much trouble swinging a club. So is it worse? Is what happened in South Africa, did it make it worse at all? Or do you feel worse about the current state of it right now than you did when you left Africa?
No, I mean, it feels much better than when I left Africa, for sure. Obviously, I had a lot of physio treatment on it, and, you know, they gave me a few anti-inflammatories and painkillers, so obviously, I mean, it, you know, you can get through. I think the worst thing what's happened is I felt it go. I mean, it was sort of building up for a while, and sort of had tightness in the sort of upper left side of my back, and then on the Friday of the tournament, as I was hitting balls, getting ready to go into play, obviously felt this twinge, and you know, I was thinking about pulling out right there and then, because obviously, it felt pretty bad. And I mean, it wasn't, you know, I could still swing a golf club, but the worst thing was it was pretty hot down there, and, you know, you're walking and you're out there for 5 hours or whatever, and like I couldn't take a deep breath, and then I felt these short, shallow breaths, so it was like I was getting lightheaded and I felt like I was going to hyperventilate. So that was really the big problem on Friday. But then I think what happened, obviously I've, you know, got the stress fracture, and then I've played on with it for three more days. And I'm getting treated down there with the physios not really knowing what it is. You know, they feel like it's a muscle spasm in the back. They don't, you know, and obviously, no one can see because, you know, I didn't get a scan down there. I only got a scan when I got back to Dubai. So, you know, I'm, you know, whether I did more damage to it for playing through it, probably, but I mean, I wasn't to know at the time, and you know, I would have felt pretty bad pulling out whenever, you know, I'm done in South Africa and I'm doing Ernie a favor. And you know, it was pretty apparent that, you know, a lot of the people that came to the golf were, you know, were down to see me. And you know, I played through it and it was fine. And but I didn't really know the extent of what had happened until obviously we got to Dubai and did the scan.
That crowd down there was pretty crazy, wasn't it? I mean, well, first of all, they've never heard of the phone rules at all.
No, but that's fine. I mean, it's, you know, it's like you go, that's nothing compared to going to play in China or Korea.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, it's nothing. It's fine. And if everyone's doing it, I don't mind. And I think, you know, if, you know, I think it's a rule, I think they have adopted it on the PGA Tour, but it's, if people have their cameras out and as long as they're on silent, that's totally fine. Like I have no problem with that whatsoever. You know, it's at the end of the day, we're out there to try and win and try to play well, but we're entertaining crowds as well. I mean, they pay money to come see us, and you know, the least that they can have is a picture or something, like a souvenir from their day out watching some of the best players in the world play. So I have no problem with that if everyone's doing it. And even if there is a few flashes going off or whatever, if it's a constant noise, it's okay. It's just that one noise that,
yeah,
that puts you off. That's the thing that is tough. So, but yeah, I've no problem with phones on courses or cameras or whatever. It's like, I mean, if that's what puts you, I mean, look, I get it if it's just a very sudden noise, but, you know, you should be in the zone or concentrating enough that it doesn't bother you that much.
What about a shirtless guy running across the fairway on the 18th hole?
I watched that back. I saw that clip on Twitter, and I had no clue that had happened. Like, I didn't see him.
It was right in front of you.
I don't know. And I was sitting there watching. I was like, how did I not see this guy? That's like ridiculous.
Nobody noticed it. That was the best part. But
yeah, I know. It was. It's like, oh, it was.
It's Africa. It's Africa.
I got a chuckle out of that one.
When you're off like you are now, how much golf do you watch? Even either for injury time off? I know you haven't had a lot of injury time off in your career, but injury and just in your off weeks, do you watch a lot of golf?
This is really bad. This is how much I try to tell people I'm not a fan. I don't watch that much golf, but like the other night, I think I was in Dubai and Tiger and DJ and Jason were teeing off at like, I don't know what time it was. It was maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, Dubai time. And I went to bed and like, I woke up and it was like, I might've had to go to the bathroom or whatever. But I sort of saw the time was like 2:30 and I was like, maybe I'll stay up and watch a few holes. So I actually stayed up and watched most of it through the night. So I watch a good bit. I mean, it was Tiger's first week back in a while, and I was sort of intrigued to see how it was, just like everyone else. So, I got up in the middle of the night to watch that. So, I guess I'm a bit of a golf fan.
That's a good thing. You don't have to be embarrassed by that, but
yeah, I don't know. It's just I think it's the cool answer to be like, no, I don't watch that much golf when I'm off or whatever. But yeah, I mean, when I'm off and I want to be there, I watch a good bit of it. And as well, like I knew that if DJ had a good week, he'd go above me in the world rankings. You know, so I'm sort of keeping an eye out on those guys. Hopefully they're not, you know, pulling away from me too much. But apart from Tiger missing the cut last week, all in all, it was a decent week. Both those guys didn't do too well, so I didn't fall behind too much.
And you may have yourself maybe some open competition there for a new Ryder Cup teammate as well. Assuming you're going to be in John Rahm's ear about taking up European Tour membership, but
I would think with the new changes to the European Tour format, or you know, the changing it from 5 to 4. And especially Nolly, like, he's got his card and he's got like playing privileges, and his name did come up quite a few times in meetings over the past sort of 6 months. We're like, you know, what if, you know, we need to make it attractive enough that John Rahm wants to come over and be a member of the tour and be on the Ryder Cup team. And now he's like he's got no excuse. I mean, he's just won on the PGA Tour. I mean, he's the, you know, and everyone knew he was such a great player, but I don't think anyone knew. I mean, I thought down the stretch last week he was awesome. So, you know, hopefully he continues to play that way and he'd be a huge asset for us in front.
I know you're paying attention to this because we exchanged a few messages on it. But what did you think of how JT started off the season?
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was it was cool to watch. I mean, like I've played a lot with JT, and I've seen glimpses of it either whether it be at home at the Bears Club or on tour, and it was impressive. I mean, to follow it up. I mean, obviously, how great he played at Kapalua, and then following it up and going and shooting 59 next week and winning Sony by however many shots it was. It was really impressive, and obviously so happy for him as well. I mean, he's such a good guy. It's been a great start to the season. I mean, there's some really young guys that have done well. I mean, you've got Hideki, obviously played great before the little break that we had, and then JT's come out and played great, and then John Rahm, and it's shaping up to be a really good year.
Did you were also tweeting a little bit this week about watching the Australian Open tennis? I'm here to give you all my expert opinion on that final match. But do you have a relationship with Roger Federer at all? Did you talk to him at all since he won the Open?
No, I haven't. If anything, I've probably a little more of a relationship with Rafa than I do Roger. But I mean, I know both guys from hanging around the tennis tour for a bit and whatever. And it was Sunday couldn't have got much better for me as a sports fan, because Carl Frampton, world champion boxer from here in Northern Ireland, he fought at 8:30 in the morning, Dubai time, and then that fight went 12 rounds and went the distance, and then I actually went out for a walk. That's the other thing about being injured. I can't really do much, but I don't want to get fat, so I need to go and move and do stuff and try not to eat as much and whatever. So went out for a walk just to try and burn a few calories, and then got back and watched the Australian Open final. It was the perfect Sunday.
So speaking of the perfect Sunday and talking about watching golf, if you were to build, I wanted to ask you a few questions about in general about how the way you think golf is covered. And I want to know if you're a golf fan, what's your dream broadcast team from on course commentary, in the booth? If you're building a dream commentary team, who's on your team?
Okay. I'd say on the course would be David Faraday and Wayne Riley, who does the European Tour coverage on Sky Sports. Both really funny guys, both really good guys. I think that'd be great. In the booth, I really like Faldo. I think Faldo's a really good golf analyst. He speaks a lot of sense. And he's been there and done it. I think that's a huge thing as well about some of these guys. I mean, and someone like Johnny Miller, who some people can say can be overcritical at times. I see that in a way, but at the same time, Johnny's been there and done it, and Johnny probably played some of the best golf ever in stretches of his career. So, I mean, he remembers how easy it was at those times. I don't think he remembers how hard it can be sometimes, but I don't mind taking a little bit of criticism from him because he's been there and done it. So I think Johnny would be in there too. Jim Nantz, just because of the voice, I guess. Who else would be there? I think Dottie Pepper's really good. I think she gets it. She knows the game really well, obviously, and she was a great player in her own right, but I think she calls the shots really well. She calls this is a bad lie, this is a good lie, this shot will be difficult, this should be easy, whatever it may be. There's a lot of good ones out there. I mean, there's a few bad ones that I won't mention, but I think the majority of them are pretty good.
You're not gonna bring Brandel into the booth or for the no. post round commentary?
Honestly, the thing is, I agree with a lot of stuff that he says. I really do. I think he's very knowledgeable on the golf swing, and I think he does talk a lot of sense. But sometimes, you know, if I if I see someone that makes a comment about something that they're maybe not quite as up on as some other things, I like to just, you know, because you have a platform that you can reach a lot of people, and sometimes if what you're telling them is a little bit misguided or not quite correct, I mean, that can, you know, you don't know where that information can flow to. So sometimes I just try to not right wrongs, but at least give a factual side of the story. I mean, because there's so much subjective stuff out there. I just like to be a little bit objective at times and try to, yeah, I guess try to set the story straight, I guess.
Yeah. I know he's given you some grief in the past about your fitness regimen. I know you've covered your fitness regimen in a lot of places, but kind of, I don't think I ever asked you how would you compare? So tying this back to your injury, some people want to point immediately towards, you know, working out and it causing injury. And I heard you talk to Bacon just a bit about how, you know, you have trained professionals that are looking after every step you take. And I was curious if you had any insight as to how your training regimen or your philosophy differs at all from somebody like Tiger, who kind of revolutionized the fitness game. I don't know if you guys have ever really worked out together, but how is it similar? How is it different, kind of what your guys' goals are in the gym?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's fundamental goals, you know, as a golfer, are to stay injury-free. I think that's a big thing, and that's the reason that, for me anyway, that's the reason that I got into it, because I've struggled with a bad back for a long time. I mean, I remember when I was 17 years old, like in amateur tournaments, really struggling with my back and thinking about pulling out of events, and I didn't know what a gym was back then. You know, so I've had back problems because, I mean, I've swung a golf club since I was 2 years of age, you know, and swinging a golf club is one of the worst things you can do for your back, no matter how you swing it. I mean, people can say if you don't restrict your hip rotation on the way back and everything, but it's still, you know, you're putting a lot of stress and a lot of torque on your spine, especially when you're trying to get it out there and you're hitting it hard and obviously trying to get maximum distance out of it too. So that's my big thing is if I can protect my back by being stronger and making it more robust we call them shock absorbers. If you can put shock absorbers on your body to protect your joints, to protect your bones. Obviously I don't have enough shock absorbers cause I'm out with a bone injury, but you know what I mean? Like, if you can be strong in the right areas and stabilize the right parts of your body, it can only help and it can only lead to longevity as well. And I alluded to this in Shane's podcast last week, but, you know, it might be time, because of how athletic golf is now and how much more of a power sport it is, you're going to see guys maybe not play into their 50s, and maybe that's okay. Maybe having a 20-year career instead of a 30-year career in golf is okay. You know, it's still a long career, and you can still achieve a lot of goals, and you can still do a lot of things in the game if you have that window. So, you know, it seems like it is going to go that way, just because of, you know, coaching methods and because people have figured out, okay, this is the, you know, maybe the most efficient way to swing a golf club. And maybe if the most efficient way to swing a golf club means you're going to pick up a few injuries or a few niggles along the way, you know, that it mightn't be a bad price to pay. Yeah. And that's sort of the, you know, but at the same time, the work that you do in the gym should hopefully negate those effects that your swing may have in your body.
Yeah. Do you think also there is a certain level, and I'm not sure the best way to ask it, but being in good shape and having strong fitness, strong muscles also just adds to a level of comfort in your own skin and kind of confidence. Do you think is there an element of that that goes into something that translates onto the course as well? Just feeling confident, you know, standing on 2 feet and feeling muscular. Is there something to that?
I don't think it's about feeling muscular. I think it's about having, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I do focuses on posture. Mm-hmm. I think having good posture makes you feel better. It makes you feel taller. It makes you feel stronger anyway. You know, if your shoulders are back, you know, and you're in the right posture and you're, you know, it, you know, that's, all of a sudden that's a more positive way to carry yourself. So it mightn't even be about muscular. It might just be because we don't need to intimidate anyone on a golf course. You know, we're not trying to sort of hit them or whatever. But I think posture is a big thing, and I think talking to a lot of guys, and obviously golf is so hard on your posterior chain and your back, and if you can really concentrate on that and make that as strong as possible and as robust as possible. Of course, like being strong in the right areas is great, and it helps somewhat for golf. But yeah, of course, I mean, since going in the gym and sort of not transforming my body, but sort of it's a different look. Of course, I feel a bit better about myself. There is a bit of a confidence thing there, but I'm not sure that's helped my game, but I think getting strong in the right areas and making my swing more efficient and hopefully being less prone to injury, that's what's the big help to your game.
Yeah, I've never really understood the criticism that has come with somebody getting in shape. I thought only golf would ever criticize its own athletes for being in better physical shape. But along that same line, I'm just curious as to what you think about the current state of the way golf is covered. And if you were in charge of that, what would you do differently about the way golf is covered? And do you think it's kind of a sport that lags behind the way it's covered compared to other major sports?
I mean, I think golf has taken huge strides over the past couple of years in terms of, social media activity. Like, for example, I've repeatedly said that all of you guys and the guys that I want to give time to, the likes of yourself and the people that I've mentioned over the past few weeks, you guys have made golf fun to follow again because it's a different take on it. It's more aimed at millennials, it's fun, it's the way it should be, and it's the social media age, and this is what people appreciate. And you gotta look at something like the European, I think what the European Tour have been doing in terms of social has been unbelievable with obviously the little interviews with Billy or the mannequin challenge thing that they did. Or even that awkward reporter that they did in Abu Dhabi. I mean, that stuff is gold. Like, that is awesome. And people talk about growing the game. I mean, this is one of the best ways to grow the game is to put stuff like that out there. And, that gets more people into it. It makes people see that golf isn't this uptight sport that's only for rich, fat, white guys. It's for everyone, and everyone can come and play it, and it's open to everyone, and it's way better. So I think golf has taken some great strides over the past few years, and hopefully it continues in this vein for a long time.
Well, I got a similar idea. I'm going to run by you when we're done here for the memorial this year. So remind me on that. But we can have some good fun with the PGA Tour folks as well. But I'm asking that question as well in line with the same one. Like, how does it feel knowing that, people that write for blogs or websites are sitting there, like, listening to this right now, waiting to, and everything you say, like, in a press conference, they're sitting there and they're waiting to turn it into a blog post anytime you say something interesting, it's news. Like, somebody like Jack Nicklaus never really had to deal with that. Bobby Jones, Tiger, I think, kind of transformed that a little bit, but I know you're pretty open with the media and you're not that careful with what you say, but there's got to be times where you've been burned and it's got to still be something on your mind. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that's very accurate. There's things that you want to avoid talking about, and there's things that are just like, you would rather not go there, or I've been burned a few times. I mean, some off the cuff comment that I think is harmless can be spun in such a way that you really didn't mean for it to be that way, or people can take what they want from it. And of course, you need to be careful about what you say, but also about how you say things. But I don't want to be guarded. I want to be as open as possible, and I think people appreciate that. I think people, I think one of the great things about social media is, fans and people that follow you can get to know you a little bit better, and you can, you know, you can be yourself. You can let them into a little bit of your life, and that's okay. So it's not just okay; it's great. It's great to be able to connect with these people that support you and follow you. So, but yeah, of course, you need to be careful about what you say every now and again. But as I said, I feel people appreciate the openness and the honesty of guys that speak their mind and try to, I guess, keep it real. Right. I guess that's the thing, and that's what I try to do.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think I asked that question first because the next one I think could get construed in the wrong way, but I'm asking this in a lighthearted way because I've lived in Europe for a few years now. Obviously, I grew up in the States, and I love asking Europeans like what they find absurd or funny about Americans. It's a little different from you. You're a European, lives in the U.S., and the U.S. has been a big part of your life and culture for a long time, but not growing up in the States, and I'm just curious, what do you find baffling or just kind of amusing about Americans in general?
their fascination with guns.
Okay.
That's a big thing. Not wanting to get too political. I guess for me, like, it always baffles me because I think, like, in Europe or especially where I'm from, like, I wouldn't know the first place to go to try and buy a gun or get a gun or whatever like that, where, you know, you can literally walk into a Walmart in the States, and if you're of a legal age and you can get a license, you can buy. Like, I remember seeing a gun for the first time in the States, and I was like, oh my God, that's, you know, it's sort of scary. But, like, I guess it's a right that citizens have, and I respect that and whatever, but I've always found that a little unnerving just because of the taboo around guns where I'm from, because of where I'm from and the troubles and everything. It's just, it's a little bit different. But going more lighthearted, I guess.
That's what I was going to go lighthearted. Like, people always tell me that we're really loud, but you went straight for guns, man. I didn't see that coming.
Well, I don't know. Let's see, lighthearted. I've played and traveled to the U.S. since I was a kid, and I've always really enjoyed it. I think the one thing that I like about it, I don't know if it's because of my Irishness or whatever, but people are always super friendly, like really friendly. And it's because, you know, I always feel like anytime you meet an American, they say, oh, I'm half Irish or quarter Irish or whatever. And so there's always some sort of instant connection there. But America is where I've sort of made my home now. And I'm going to have an American wife very soon. And I don't really want to say too much bad stuff. So
I didn't even say bad stuff.
I don't want to get in trouble.
I didn't say you had to go for bad stuff. That's where your mind went. But how are you and Erica going to decide what Ryder Cup or Solheim Cup team your kids are going to play for?
Oh, geez. I guess will they be dual citizens one day?
You thought you were going to get away from your Great Britain, Ireland, having to make a decision.
That's fine. I don't.
Now you have to decide between continents.
That's a tough one. They got to follow. I mean, Erica did a pretty good job supporting the Europeans this year or last year, so I think we're going to have to stay with Europe on that one.
Yeah, that was your safer answer there too. I want to know, you seem to me like to be a very easy guy to get to know, which kind of surprises me for a guy of your level of fame. So I want to know, how big is your circle, like your circle of friends? How big is the group of people that you stay really close with, that you hang out with in Florida, in Ireland? Because I don't really hear a lot about like your big group, or I think you kind of keep that close to the chest. But how big is that group? You keep a pretty tight-knit group.
I do. I mean, I have a handful of very close friends that I've known my whole life, basically. And then, like, I have guys that I know from tour and guys that I've played golf with growing up and whatever. But it's hard. I mean, when you get in a position like this, I know the people that have known me since I was a kid and just know me as who I am, and not the guy that is this good golfer and has won golf tournaments and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, there's people from back home who I would deem as very close friends, my best friends, and then I've got acquaintances, I guess. But more than that, more than acquaintances, I mean friends, you know, friends that I like to hang out with and friends that I really enjoy spending time with. But mostly, you know, the guys that I grew up at home with, they're the really close ones, and the ones that if I would ever be in trouble or if I ever needed anything, they're the first ones I call.
I guess, have you ever been burned by any people close to you at some point in your life, letting you down or simply clearly just wanting something from you that was inappropriate in any way?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, look, I went through a legal battle with a former manager at one point, so like I know all about being burned and about feeling like you've been taken advantage of, I guess. But in terms of friendships, not really. No, I mean I'm a pretty trusting person. I'm a pretty open person, but again, I think, you know, the people that I have around me are lifelong friends and don't really want anything else from me but to, you know, just continue that friendship, I guess. But yeah, it's hard. You go through life and it's, you know, you do automatically have this extra layer, or this, you put your guard up a little more often because you're a little skeptical and you don't know whether someone's being friendly just because they're being friendly or something, or, you know, but it's the way of the world, I guess. And with someone in my position, you always just have to be a little bit skeptical at times, but I think I'm a pretty good judge of who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And, you know, I feel like I can make a pretty good judgment on people pretty quickly.
When you're in town for like a tournament week, what does it look like socially for you? I mean, I imagine like every stop you go, there's somebody that you know in some connection that wants to have a meal. Do you mostly keep to yourself during a tournament week, or do you, you know, limit yourself to one or two nights out for an easy dinner, or what does it typically look like?
Yeah, I mean, I'd much rather go out for dinner at tournament weeks than stay in the hotel room or have room service, unless we're renting a house and you know, we'll stay in and cook or whatever. But yeah, I mean, typical week is usually, yeah, as you said, I mean, I I'm at the point now, I've been on tour a decade, so, like, I've gotten to know people pretty much at every tour stop that I go to, and, yeah, of course, there's people that want to have dinner and want to take you out and whatever, and that's really nice. But yeah, you try to limit it to maybe one or two nights a week and just try to do something quiet, whether it's with the team, like if my family are there or Eric is there or whoever, like I'd go out for dinner with them most of the time. But then there's other points where, you know, you'll catch up with some of the guys on tour, whether it be Ricky or JT or whoever, you know, you'll go out and you'll have a bit of dinner with those guys as well. But for the most part, it's pretty much, you know, it's sort of got to the point now where everyone has their little team around them, whether it be coach, caddy, physio, manager, whoever. So I think most guys now just sort of stick to that.
That was actually my next question. I feel like you seem to be pretty involved kind of in handling like your own affairs. Like for instance, if I want a player on the podcast, I typically have to go through their agent or manager in some way to get it arranged. But do you keep, how big is your team in general? And is that something that you kind of like to, do you keep it small on purpose and keep, I guess, kind of the executive decisions and the small day-to-day stuff? Do you like to keep that really close to you, or is that like very well handled by your management office? What's your overall strategy or thought process in that regard?
Yeah, I'm in a very fortunate position where I sort of do the things that I want to do, especially this sort of stuff. I mean, if I like something or I want to do something, I'll do it. It's not as if I need to go through people to sort of get the okay from it. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice thing about being in this position. But I think I directly employ directly employ like 10, 11 people. But then indirectly, I have probably around 30 people working for me, like from financial guys, tax guys, legal counsel, brand agencies. Oh, there's so much. I mean, there's so much stuff that goes into it. And like, I would never have dreamed that I would have all these people around me whenever I was starting off my career. I didn't have a clue about all this sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, indirectly, there's probably around 30 people that work for me, which is nuts to think about, but I guess it's just the way it is.
Does that stuff at this point kind of run itself, though, or are you heavily involved in the day-to-day with a lot of those people?
So we have quarterly board meetings. So like four board meetings a year that basically I just get an update on what's going on. So I'm not that involved, but obviously I need to be involved in some of the decisions and stuff that's going on, obviously. But yeah, they try to whittle it down for me so that, you know, they give me a brief summary of everything that's going on. And if I need to make a few decisions here and there, I do, but you know, I try to stay out of it for the most part.
After you, let's say you win a tournament, what do you do next? Like, I'd imagine your media requests shoot through the roof that following week, but do you ever, like, change plans and just say, hey, let's go to this island this week? Or do you really reward yourself after a win? Or I guess we get, at this point, with as many times as you've won, we can say there's a normal routine after it.
Yeah, but normal routine. you know, I took a bit of advice from Padraig Harrington back in the day. And he said, really savor your wins, because as a golfer, we lose much more than we win, which is very true. You know, we get the opportunity to win a few times a year, and hopefully you take a few of those. And but you know, like when winning three or four times a year is a pretty big success in golf. You know, not many people enjoy that sort of success, so you have to enjoy your wins. I mean, what's all the hard work for and everything if you can't enjoy it when you actually do it? So yeah, I mean, of course, I wouldn't say I have a set routine, but I mean, it would usually involve a few beers or a few bottles of wine or a few something, just to, you know, we try to be disciplined throughout the year to get ourselves in a position where we can win big tournaments and achieve big goals. So like even after the FedEx Cup last year and winning the Tour Championship, I mean, like I had a massive hangover that Monday, but we had a day off, so that was fine. But I mean, usually not the best way to start a Ryder Cup week, but you know, you have to enjoy your successes. And thankfully by Friday I was feeling okay and was able to play pretty well. But yeah, geez, you got to do these things. I mean, you got to enjoy the success. I mean, if you don't enjoy it, then what's the point in doing it?
Yeah, I was going to judge you if the answer was anything other than that, so that's good.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you going, you missed out on it last year, famously. Are you going to Spring Break 2K17?
I am not going to Spring Break 2K17, no. I think...
you have other priorities that month?
I have a few things going on in April.
I figured that was the answer, but wasn't sure if... it looks like you're missing out 2 years in a row.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you... going back a bit from your junior days, were there any tournaments specifically that, like, eluded you, or guys growing up that just had your number that still, like, kind of stick with you, that you still remember?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a guy who, like, I might have beaten him once or twice, but there was a guy from Arizona called Philip Francis, who, he actually went to UCLA and played college golf. I'm not sure what he's doing now, but, like, I just could not beat this kid. He won everything that we played in, whether it be Junior World or whatever else. So Philip Francis, he was the stud of our age division back in the day. And he was really good. And he was a really good guy as well. Actually, it was Philip Francis, Scott Pinkney, who played on tour last year, Tony Finau, myself. There was a few of us, and yeah, so Philip Francis was the one. I felt like I could never beat him. I might have gotten the better of him a couple of times, but that was it. And then I never made it past the first round of the British Amateur either. That was one of the big things. I remember playing Lytham in 07, qualified pretty easily, the 36-hole stroke play, and going into the match play, last 64, I draw a guy called Daniel Willett in the first round, and I'd never heard of the guy before. And I was like, Daniel Willett, never heard of him, he should be easy. Danny was 6-under through 7, and I was like, I think I was like 4 or 5 down. I actually ended up making a bit of a comeback, but he beat me 2-1. I was like, this guy's actually pretty good. And then he ended up playing on the Walker Cup team. So we played the Walker Cup together that year, and then obviously Danny's went on to do what he's done, and Masters champ and everything. So, you know, he was another one that, I think I was playing well that week as well. If I had just got past Danny, I might have made a bit of a run. But, there you go.
Your memory of the specific memory, like being 6 down or 6 under through 7 and throw. I've heard your interviews before where you can reference, like, 2007 I hit 7 iron from 186. Like, you can tell how much some of this stuff sticks with you. I wasn't. I thought you were going to say the Irish amateur based on a conversation you and I had a few months ago.
Irish amateur as well. That was the only one that I didn't win. I mean, there's, again, it's like, you know, even though, you know, I've went on since then, and I've achieved quite a lot, and I've done whatever I've done. Like, these things still sting a little bit, and they shouldn't, because, I mean, what does it matter now? But at the same time, it's like, oh, you know, it's just that little tinge of regret that you didn't win it, or you didn't get the better of whatever guy it was. But Portmarnock 2006. Irish stroke play. Yeah, that was tough. That was one of those ones where, you know, it came down to, it was a playoff, and even before that, like, even the back nine was a bit of a battle, and I just kept hitting fairways and kept hitting greens and wasn't holding anything, and this finished left-hander, Andy Ahokas, basically hitting it all over the place, but getting up and down from everywhere. And then he did the exact same thing. Like, I hit fairways and greens in the playoff the first two holes, but didn't make a birdie. He up and downed it both times, and then we both hit it onto the next green, like a 30 footer, and missed. And then he held from like 20 feet to win. So, anyways, it's fine. It's fine. I'm not too bitter about it. But
10 and a half years ago, you can list the hole by hole.
I know exactly, but it is like it's funny, like, it shouldn't bug you, but I think just being a competitor and being proud of my record and all that stuff, it still gets me a little bit.
My reason for asking that, or a transition there, is it seems you've won 4 majors, obviously. Other than the 2010 PGA, I don't feel like, I'm discounting the 2011 Masters, I think that's a different category, but I don't feel like you've had any really major close calls in a major. That, you know, you've won 4 without having like that real heartbreak of being super, super close. Do you attribute that to anything? Like, not even, like, even Tiger had a ton of like third place finishes and a few runner ups, and not nearly as many as Nicklaus did. But do you equate that to anything in particular?
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely feel like I've turned into a decent closer. I think early on in my career, that would have been a bit of a criticism. I used to get myself in decent positions, but especially back in like 09 and 10 and even 11, where I get myself in decent positions after 3 rounds, and then I throw a 73 or a 74 at it and finish wherever. So, but it took me a while to learn how to close tournaments out. Probably took me a little bit longer than some guys, but, luckily, I've been on tour since I was 18, so I had a bit of time to learn. I don't know. I mean, I finished 3rd in the PGA at Hazeltine in 09, finished 3rd at St. Andrews in 10, finished 1 shot out of the playoff at Whistling Straits in 10. And then, obviously, I had that bad afternoon at Augusta in 11, and I think that's really what changed things. It's almost like you need to go through something like that, or at least I did, to really learn from it. And I did. I really did. I learned a lot from that. And not, you know, people say they learn from their successes and they learn, but I really learned from that, because, like, I knew what not to do. Like, I remember my thought process, and I remember everything that happened that day. So at least I knew going forward, okay, I don't really want to do that again. So then I was able to win the U.S. Open, and everything just sort of kicked on from there. But the catalyst for becoming a decent closer was that what happened at Augusta that afternoon.
Did the way people kind of frame Tiger's career, and I think he cut it out for them, and you know, putting his goals so high, but obviously he did things at the highest level that people have never done before. But it certainly appears as if he's going to come up short of 18 majors, and almost from the last, you know, people look at his career at this point as what could have been. Did the way that people kind of viewed that affect the way you kind of set your own goals? You've always been, you've said it in the past, you want to become, you know, the best European player of all time. You want to win the career Grand Slam, but you never gave yourself this too high of a measure to measure yourself against and for the people to point at and say you didn't make it. Did what happened with Tiger influence that at all?
I think so, a little bit. Like, I've always been one to set lofty goals, and I've openly said, look, of course I want to try to become the best European ever, but I think they're very realistic goals. They're goals that are achievable, but again, at the same time, like, you know, say that doesn't happen, I'm still not going to view my career as a failure. I mean, I still feel like I achieved, you know, if it was all to go away tomorrow, I still feel like I've achieved a lot in the game, and I've set out for the most part what I wanted to do. I mean, when I was 9 years old, I said I wanted to be the best golfer in the world and win all the majors. Well, I've pretty much done all that apart from one thing. So, like, and it's the same thing with Tiger. It's like he set out to win 19 majors or, you know, surpass Jack or whatever. But, you know, he's won 14 majors. He's won 80 times on the PGA Tour. He's won over 100 times worldwide. You know, that is not a failure. I mean, but unfortunately, people are going to see his career as a failure because he didn't achieve what he set out to achieve. And that's ludicrous, like absolutely ludicrous. He played the best golf of anyone in the world ever for like a 10-year stretch that, you know, it was golf that no one had seen before.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just, it brought so many people to the sport, and it ignited a generation of golfers that you see now coming through, the likes of Justin Thomas, Hideki Matsuyama, Jordan Spieth, John Rahm, myself, just so many guys, you know, that were just inspired by what he did on a golf course. So, you know, he transcended the game of golf, and he is nothing but a success and a credit to the game of golf. And I would love if he would just give it one last run. If he was just allowed the opportunity to be healthy for a few years and just give it one last run, because I'd love to compete against him down the stretch of a major, and I'm sure a lot of these guys would. But just for golf, just for the fans, just one more time, it would be awesome.
I was listening to Alan Shipnuck's podcast with Phil, and obviously everyone asks players, do you think Tiger will win again? And I usually don't find the answers very interesting, but I thought the way Phil answered it was very convincing to me, and that nobody knows Tiger as a competitor better than Phil does. And Alan asked him, and Phil said, do you think he's going to win again? Phil said, oh, yeah. Like, his instinct was just like, oh, yeah. Like, there was no doubt, and he was just convinced in his voice. Do you feel the exact same way?
I hope he does. I think he's swinging the club much better than people give him. Like, you know, I saw some reactions to the stuff last week, and like, if you look at his backswing, I mean, where he's taking the club away, where he's putting the club at the top of the swing, it's really good. I mean, it's so on plan. And if he can just get his lower body to work a little bit better through the ball, he is going to be, you know, he's right there. He's so close. And I, like, even that second round last week, if he had held some putts and got a little bit of momentum, because, I mean, he putted well, and he a lot of putts just sort of chafed by the hole. And if he had got a little bit of momentum on that Friday, you know, he would have made the cut easily, and you never know what could have happened on the weekend. But he's close. He's closer than people think. I can assure you that.
Yeah, I'm for sure not burying him, especially considered, you know, everyone in his threesome missed the cut. It's a really tough golf course, especially if you're not driving it well. I was a little concerned that he wasn't swinging it as freely as he was out in the Bahamas, but I think, you know, the width of the fairways has a lot to do with that overall difficulty of the course.
And, I mean, you know, yeah. Albany has 50-yard wide fairways, and, you know, he's, it's, you know, basically, like, he knows that golf course. Obviously, he knows Torrey Pines as well, but I think the 50-degree weather didn't help either. Like, I think that was going to be a big thing of keeping his back warm and making sure he was loose the whole way around, especially, I mean, it was slow out there too. I mean, it was really slow. So, I wouldn't read any too much into last week. I think Dubai this week will be a much better gauge of how he's playing, and I think just shaking a bit of that rust off, I think he'll be totally fine.
Yeah, speaking of, a few more questions, and I'll let you get out of here, man. I'm taking up a lot of your time, but speaking of 50-yard wide fairways, I've never heard you discuss this topic. Maybe you haven't thought that far ahead, but do you ever want to get into golf course design in the future?
I've had a few opportunities already to get into golf course design. I'm actually in the process of speaking to a few guys, and there's an offer on the table for Jack and I to co-design a golf course in Florida, which would be awesome. We've talked about that before, and I think, you know, with what Jack did in the past was, like, when he first started, he I think it was Pete Dye who he teamed up with and started to, he sort of learned from Pete a little bit, and then as he got more comfortable with it, he took on a design team himself and then went out and did his own stuff. But, you know, it would just be great to tag along, even just to learn from him and learn from his designers, like what goes into designing a golf course, and, you know, something that I would be really interested in one day. I mean, I'm still, like, I'm 27 years of age, and my focus in golf is playing golf and trying to win tournaments. But, it would be a great interest to get into, you know, one day whenever, you know, I'm not competitive anymore and I maybe want to stay within golf but do something a little different. And, you know, at 27 years of age, to have the opportunity to tag along with Jack Nicklaus and see how they go about designing a golf course, I think would be really cool.
Yeah. Do you, so you travel obviously everywhere for golf. We talked last time about how much you enjoy your time at home when you're actually able to get it. But I noticed when you went down to South Africa, you went down a few days early. You guys did a safari in Kruger while you were down there. I was curious if you had somewhere on your list or somewhere you'd like to go in the world just for solely for personal travel. Golf clubs aren't coming. I'm not sure if you guys are doing a big honeymoon or anything like that. But where's somewhere that you want to go in the world for personal travel?
Yeah, there's a lot of places. I'd love to go to the South Island in New Zealand. Somewhere I'd love to go to Queenstown and see. I mean, it looks beautiful there. French Polynesia, Bora Bora, you know, that looks incredible too. There's actually, I think it was like the 100th anniversary of like the national parks in the US last year. And like when I was over there, or when I spend a lot of time in the States, and they had this thing on the Today Show where they were going around a lot of the national parks and sort of giving you an insight into like Yosemite and White Sands Monument and all this sort of stuff. And I'd love to go and sort of just do a road trip across the United States and see, because there's so much cool stuff. Like, I've never been to the Grand Canyon. Like, I'd love to see the Hoover Dam. Like, all this sort of stuff is awesome. And I'd love to just take a car for a few weeks and go and take a road trip across America and see everything there is.
There you go. So what, we'll end this really lighthearted. I'm curious, do you have like any accents that you can impersonate? Like can you impersonate an American accent, or do you have any go-to accents you can do?
I can do an American accent. I think, yeah, it's easy to do that. It depends. I'm almost getting to the point where I can distinguish where someone is from in America. Well, like for example, my fiance and her family are from Rochester, and it's very nasally up there. Like, they say salad instead of like a salad, they say salad, and like their A's are very flat. So I can sort of get that, and then you can sort of distinguish where everyone's from in the States. And I'm not going to try to do the accent on the podcast here.
Damn it.
I'm not going to embarrass myself that much.
That's what I was going for. Well, my recently divorced friend that is really good at accents wants to know if a credible Irish accent will help him pick up girls at a bar.
It's known to work in the past, yes. That's, yeah, I mean, I think anyone with an accent in the States has a better chance at picking up someone at a bar.
One up advantage. All right, last one. I shouldn't have waited till the very end to ask you about it because I know you're excited about it. Irish Open this year at Port Stewart. How excited are you for that? What kind of field are we looking at so far? In general, how you got a new date for it? It's in July, I think, this year. How excited are you for the Irish Open?
Yeah, very excited for the Irish Open. I mean, it's a tournament that's always been very close to me, but even more so now with having the involvement through the foundation. As you said, yeah, it's this year from the 6th to the 9th of July, Port Stewart, which is like 3 or 4 miles up the road from Port Rush, where the Open is, in a couple of years' time. Great golf course in its own right. Links course, which we think is very important that the Irish Open stays on a links venue. I mean, when people come to Ireland to play golf, they want to play links golf. So I think that's very important. I think it's huge that the European Tour have elevated it to one of the Rolex Series events. You know, we were very appreciative that, you know, we've worked with Keith Pelly and the team and trying to make it this big event and one of the biggest on the European Tour. $7 million prize fund. You know, it's 2 weeks before the Open, so, you know, there's a nice little bit of a link stretch going into it. Hopefully the weather's a little bit better. We've sort of been unlucky with the weather the last couple of years, but hopefully the better date in July will help us with that. And then the field, I mean, you know, like I feel like, you know, the location of the tournament, the date of the tournament, and even the prize fund of the tournament, it really should attract some of the best golfers in the world. Like, I'll still ask a few people if they want to come over and play. I know a few people that played at County Down a couple of years ago, like Ricky. He can't play because he's got quick wins the week before, and then I think he's made a commitment to maybe come back and play the Scottish. But there's some other guys that I know that are interested to come over and play, and if I can get a few of them from, you know, obviously from over in the States, and hopefully, you know, it'll be a really strong European Tour turnout as well. You know, it should be the best Irish Open in years.
That's what I was going to say. Are you counting on guys to have that, was it purposeful to have it 2 weeks before the Open, thinking that guys might come over, maybe spend a week, maybe either play the Scottish Open the next week or rest that week? Was it purposeful to try to run it into the Open?
Yeah, I was trying to get the date as close to the Open as possible. I mean, that was the plan. I think having two links events running into the Open works perfectly. It does. It lets guys come and play a links course, a links event, get over some jet lag. You know, if they want to play 2 weeks leading into the major, if they want to play the Irish Open, then a week off, and then play the Open. It opens up a whole bunch of opportunities for guys to come over and get acclimatized, play some links golf, and whether they want to play the Irish or the Scottish or both. But it's definitely a better date for us, and hopefully the guys turn out for it, because, you know, it's going to be a great event, great golf course, and so it's decent defending champion, so it's all good.
I'm coming. You've already recruited me. I'm coming this year.
Perfect. Yes, exactly. I'm trying to recruit all you guys. I mean, if I can get you guys to come over and cover it and support the event, that can only be a good thing.
Say no more. I'm convinced. But I'm going to let you go, man. I didn't mean to mention, though, really enjoyed your interview you did with Paul Kimmage. I thought that was awesome. And I think it's awesome that you take your time and give it to guys like ourselves and Shane and whatnot. I know it's really appreciated by the listeners, appreciated by all of us, and your support of us. It means a lot. So thanks a ton for the time, man. Have a safe trip to Florida, and we'll do it again.
Thank you. No, thanks for having me on. As I said, I think you guys are the future of what golf coverage is going to look like, and anything I can do to support, I'm here.
Much appreciated, man. Cheers.
Thank you.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most. How about him? That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything.